My name is Sue Bergen, and I'm happy to introduce this session. We thank you for attending, and the title is The Mormon Mind Game, Common Mormon Thinking Errors. So,
dun, dun, dun.
So this session is being recorded. You've all heard this already. You'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We encourage you to also purchase other Sunstone merchandise or to make a donation to help support these amazing events. The session is 60 minutes long, and we'll be keeping within that framework. And if you're asking questions toward the end, help us wrap it up if we're having lots of enthusiastic participation. Little about this presentation. Every culture, organization, religion, and person experiences thinking errors, commonly called cognitive distortions. This session will build off of Jennifer and Natasha's, I'll introduce them in a moment, popular session previously called Mormon Thinking Errors. And this is going to take the conversation further and offer concrete strategies to combat cognitive distortions. Natasha Helfer Parker on your far right. She is an LCMFT, CST, and the owner and founder of Symmetry Solutions, a group practice of mental health therapists and wellness coaches. She's been in practice for more than 20 years, specializing in mental health therapy, sexuality concerns, family couple services, and faith transitions within spiritual journeys. Sarah Hughes Zabawa, in the middle, on the end, I'm sorry, to your left, is a licensed clinical social worker, wellness coach, and yoga instructor who specializes in treating trauma, depression, and anxiety. She often works with LGBT plus individuals and their families to foster acceptance and promote advocacy skills, as well as individuals and couples experiencing life transitions related to their faith. Jennifer White, in the middle, is a therapist who specializes in helping people with depression, anxiety, sexuality concerns, trauma, and faith transitions slash journeys. And I'm privileged to be part of their group practice also. So we'll turn the time over to them.
So this was a really fun presentation last year that I was able to attend, and I'm excited to be with Natasha and Jennifer. And it's fun because we want a lot of people to contribute. Wow. See, it's already off to a bang.
Right here.
Perfect. So I just want you to recognize that we are all here and we all have cognitive disorders. We all have thinking errors because we're human. So if you're breathing today and you're sitting in your chair, you're with me. We all have them. So I want us to start really thinking about what ones we have so we can start sharing and think about them within the context of Mormonism. As Mormons, we're peculiar people, but we're not unique. Like I said, all of us experience cognitive distortions. Typically within religious cultures, Mormonism is a culture, Catholicism is a culture. There are common thinking errors, thinking patterns, or thinking narratives associated to religious beliefs or religious community living. So that's what we're going to be highlighting today. The very basic definition of a cognitive distortion is, or thinking errors, are the different ways our mind convinces us of something when it isn't really true.
We dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Sorry.
I need to do my dun, dun, dun's.
I like those.
Okay.
They're good.
So you're okay with that?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Perfect. We do have a handout. We had no idea that we'd have so many awesome people here. So if you don't have your cognitive distortion handout, please stop by our table, and I would be happy to email you a PDF copy.
Yeah, and before we get started into kind of taking apart the way we're thinking and looking at our thinking errors, I wanted to address that we all have emotions, and our feelings are always valid. Our emotions are just information for us to learn from that. And when I think about this, I think about how helpful is it when someone says, stop feeling angry, stop being depressed.
It really helps me, Jennifer. It stops it right away.
Right away. Okay. Just like that. No problem. So I like to just validate that and give room for that, and that that's information. And then we can look at our thoughts and our beliefs and how that affects what's going on for us. And that will be much more effective, research even shows this, in order to help us to be emotionally in a better place.
And just to back up what she's saying, feelings are an interesting thing, because even though we're saying all feelings are valid, we also want to just encourage you to understand that our feelings can lie to us sometimes, which is what this whole thing is about. So it's difficult when you have a feeling, which is very real, and it happens, and it oftentimes it has a physiological effect as well. And then to not see some truth in that. But I think what we're going to be talking about today is kind of discerning between thoughts, feelings, and then actions that follow that. And they're all kind of intertwined, and sometimes they're very valid and very, they have some truth associated with them, and other times they're not as helpful or useful. So hopefully we're going to help you discern how to know the difference.
Yeah, and I love how you mentioned about whether they're useful or not. A part of that is, I guess when I'm feeling angry, if I start to feel guilty about that, that isn't helpful. So that was more my point.
Unless you hit me over with a bat, then I'm okay with you feeling a little guilt in your anger.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
About the action. Yes. I validate that.
So these are some examples of common cognitive distortions. So researchers throughout the years have seen trends in thinking patterns, right, or thinking errors, and labeled them. So for those of you who do have a handout, and if you could let your neighbor look too, does anybody have any ones that are their favorites? I know I have my favorite thinking errors, ones that I just like step into like a comfortable shoe, like I got this one.
Anyone? And we're expecting you to shout out, and then we'll repeat it into the mic.
Personalization.
Mm-hmm. What? Like what?
Well, like if someone does something, you know, maybe they come to work with a bad attitude. I'm like, well, what did I do?
If somebody comes to work with a bad attitude, I must be the reason why they are having a bad attitude. What did I do? Mm-hmm. Did I hear somebody else? Emotional reasoning. Give me an example.
I feel bad, therefore I am bad.
I feel bad, therefore I am bad. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And that's true, by the way. I'm sorry to tell you stuff. Yes.
Should statements.
You're shitting on yourself? Is that what you're telling me? Okay. All right.
We should not shit on ourselves, you guys.
Yes.
We see that within Mormonism is, I should have gone to church. I should have paid my tithing. I should have done a mission. I should have, right?
The bread making is what really got to me.
I should make bread?
Yes. Yes.
Hmm.
Ooh. I'm sorry to have brought some of those to the table, but yes, blaming the victim. Please try to control yourself. Thank you. Anybody else?
Jumping to conclusions
and mind reading. Like, what's an example? We make assumptions like in Sunday school about what people were thinking by what they were saying. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Or we know they were talking about us, even though we have absolutely no proof, hence why it's magical.
Yes, in the very back.
Overgeneralization,
you always do this, everything's always this way. So using the words always or never are ways that we tend to do that, yeah. How many of you are very open to the suggestion of a spouse or friend who says, you always do this? How many of you are like, you're right, thank you for pointing that out to me. I'm very open to that suggestion.
Yes.
Yes, so the question is, what is magical thinking?
So the definition is the belief that acts will influence unrelated situations. I'm a good person, so bad things shouldn't happen to me, right? A lot of moral scrupulosity or OCD or What is it when we do think like we do things hoping that it'll have a magical outcome, right? These are these behaviors that show up. I'm trying to make a really concrete example.
Is a concrete example like in the scripture story where the people were cutting themselves hoping because the liquid comes out of their arms, they're hoping it'll make it rain?
Yeah, so if the scriptural story where they're cutting their arms hoping that that will make it rain, like
sympathetic magic. You
know? Sympathetic magic.
Another example is if we pay our tithing, nothing bad will happen to our family, right? So we're doing an action with the hope that it will safeguard us from everything else, not having a rational balance of understanding bad things happen to everyone regardless of a certain amount of money paid, right?
If we have a family home evening every single Monday, then our children will not stray from the church. The very back. So she's saying about, so missionaries, if they're not getting conversions or opening of doors, then somehow the onus is on them. I mean, they're masturbating, not praying enough, not being obedient enough. Thank you.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me that we often blame ourselves when it really has something to do with someone else's choices and actions. So somehow we didn't do something right, blaming ourselves.
And I want to be very clear, too, as we're bringing some of these up, that these are not, I mean, we don't come up with these because we're stupid, right? We come up with these because they're a huge part of our narrative. I mean, these things have actually been taught to us, or we've been told that these are maybe ways we should be thinking. So I don't want to, by any means, blame or shame the audience, right, for having some of these cognitive distortions.
If we're honest and self-aware, we all have these. Every day. It's very common.
Yeah, we all
have them. Even therapists.
Right, but there's a difference between the cognitive distortion of I am not enough, which is a fairly universal one, versus the cognitive distortion of if you would just not masturbate on your mission, you would have more converts, because that's actually been said by leaders, right? So I just want to make that distinction of things that are more universal versus things that are more Mormon-centric. Any other thoughts? Yeah, in the very back. Are cognitive distortions always bad for your mental health?
I'm so glad you asked that question.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's a different, it's not dun, dun, dun.
That was a different tone. It's so unique to the individual person. So for example, we have an example coming up, but I'll just do it right now because it's a perfect segue, is the belief that everything happens for a reason. Right? For one person, that can be motivating, that can help them move through grief, that can help them feel empowered with something really negative that happens. You say that to a mother who just lost a child, that cognitive distortion may not support them in their healing or may not support them in their grief. So this is why cognitive distortions, as we step into them as unique individuals, shift and change depending on how they impact our wellness. How they impact our behaviors and how they impact our bodies. So no, they're not all negative. It's how we inhabit them. It's how they influence us and how they move through our decision-making and our behaviors.
Great question.
I almost planted that. That was so good. So the question is, like, why does this matter? It matters because how we think impacts how we feel. And as we learn to challenge what we say with our little kids, stinking thinking, we can also alter how we feel, how our moods are, how we move through the world, how we connect with other people. So this matters. Identifying what we're thinking and if any form of it is distorted does alter our sense of self and how we move through the world.
And this is just an important slide, just to kind of demonstrate and visually see the effect of our thoughts really influence our emotions and our behaviors, you know? And sometimes some of those thoughts might be affecting motivation and us not doing things. And so that's where we might want to challenge some of those. Our behavior has a huge influence also on our thoughts and our emotions, as well as how we're feeling. I mean, at least when I'm feeling bad, it's harder to be productive, you know? So all these things are just interrelated. And it's harder, again, to, like, change how we're feeling. But if we kind of can look at our behaviors and thoughts, there's a lot of tools to help us with that. And that'll influence our feelings in a positive way.
And the main part, I think, of this slide is, again, there's no, if you don't mind, there's no beginning point, right? So it's really important to understand that we tend to be linear beings. Much of what cognitive distortions are about is you just trying to organize data. So if you think about your brain as a computer, there's all this information coming into your, you know, well, into your life every day, and you can't process all of that information every single day. Have any of you seen 50 First Dates? Nobody? Was it rated R? And I didn't know. Anyway, so that's a story, obviously, where she has, she forgets every day. Every day she wakes up, she has to relearn her whole world every day. And so that would take a lot of energy. So our data organizers in our brain are trying to simplify our lives. And sometimes this is actually really good, that we label and we organize. But it's also how we have biases and discriminations, because we make assumptions very quickly. You know, we put people into boxes just by whether or not you've got a beard, whether or not you've got long hair. I can tell a lot about your activity status in the church just on how you're dressed. You can tell I'm not wearing garments. You can tell, what can I tell? Well, I won't pick on any of you. So we have these markers and we make assumptions, right? You might consider me inactive. I'm actually fairly active in my ward. So those are kinds of things that we do because we're trying to organize data. So again, not all of this is bad, but it's not linear either. And many cognitive distortions are about trying to make sense of something. If this happened, then why, right? Why did that happen? How can I explain it? How can it make sense in my world? And sometimes those explanations we come up with are either helpful or not helpful, true or not true, or a combination of all those things. Does that make sense? Okay.
Yeah, and often, just to add to that, our thoughts come from our core beliefs and sometimes our self-defeating beliefs and how those are influenced. So that's part of this too.
So really quick, just to bring it all the way so you're integrated in this. If you have the thought that nobody likes me, I just want you to take a deep breath and that thought, like, sit in your head. Nobody likes me. Feelings of sadness, self-consciousness, you might have a little bit of anxiety show up. So then those, that thought moves into a feeling or an emotion into the body, right? The body responds to that. You can feel overwhelmed. You can feel tense. You can have heart palpitations, anxiety, which is a feeling, cause physiological sensations, right? And then we manage our behavior off of that. So then we withdraw. But then think about this. You're withdrawing. How hard is it for you to connect with other people to challenge the thinking process that nobody likes you? So it perpetuates itself, which is why it's so important that we start recognizing where the thought distortions show up so we can break the cycle. Because look how differently this feels in your body, which is more rational. I have a few close friends I can really trust. So it's not everyone loves me, right? It's not that over-exaggeration.
Not everyone's going to love you. Sorry.
You can't win them all.
I feel like the negative Nelly today.
So if you have that thought, a few close friends really love me. You feel kind of more validated. You're feeling secure. Kind of maybe some gratitude, right? That already makes my body feel more calm. I feel a little bit more centered or grounded or present. That awareness will probably allow me to interact with other people a little bit more easily, right? Which can kind of revalidate the thought that I have a few close friends. I might reach out and express gratitude. So this is why it matters. It connects, it influences so much of how we act and how we show up in the world. So before we give you examples of the Mormon mind game and cognitive distortions within Mormonism, we want to turn it over to you. What are some of the ones you haven't experienced or encountered in your spectrum of your Mormon experience?
And again, we're just going to shout them out. Mm-hmm. Right. So, no. What are some common distortions, especially from kind of a Mormon framing?
And we can give you an example. So, like, to get started, right? If you are sad, depressed, anxious, or struggling, it's because you haven't repented or because you have done something wrong. Who here has heard that? That mental illness is a deficit or a moral character flaw.
Yeah.
Right? Please, please do.
Do you mind coming up to the microphone if you're going to make a longer comment? Sorry, I'm guessing I'm not going to repeat all this.
Anyway, it was when it was first happening. I was actually living in California, and one of the stake presidents in San Francisco, his son had just jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge to his suicide, and there were a lot of things happening. So that I don't know if anyone else remembers this, but the general authorities, they sent out a letter to read in church, and I thought, oh, this is wonderful. They're finally going to address the suicide rate, and maybe these kids will have something to hope for, depend on, whatever. And basically, it was just a letter that said, suicide is wrong, don't do it. And I was very upset by that. Just comments or suggestions?
I guess my first comment, I'm not exactly sure how that fits into cognitive distortions, although I think that, because the idea is that, again, kind of like somebody just told me not to be angry, just don't suicide, right? Just don't do it. Duh, right? I mean, like, why would you do so? So that shows the lack of understanding of mental health issues, for one, for sure. And what that does, unfortunately, to people who are really struggling or who maybe are in a position where that letter is symbolizing a relationship with deity, then all of a sudden that gets very convoluted, right? Because if my church leaders are saying this to me, and they obviously miss the boat and don't get what I'm going through, and now really the shame is placed on me as far as having suicidal ideation, and we play those shoulds. You know, I shouldn't be suicidal. I shouldn't have these issues. If I was just a better member, obviously the better members, they just don't do it, right? They don't suicide. So there must be something really wrong with me. And this is what now not only a man is telling me, but really a man who represents God. Wow, you know, you've just added a huge burden. And that's why I started with that idea that it's not that you or we are stupid. Like, these cognitive distortions happen in the context of culture, religion, family of origin. You know, each system that you're a part of, this is why we think these ways. You're not born thinking these ways, right? You're taught to think these ways. And what's so challenging, especially I think in our Mormon culture, is that that wrestling between these two principles that we have in Mormonism, which is one is obedience and one is self-agency, right? And we have that wrestle in our doctrine and in our theology. And we're very obedience-centric in Sunday school and in letters and in things like that. And so I don't think we do very well at that self-advocacy piece, which you can find in Mormonism if you dig enough for it. So somebody, you know, in that position would have to be in a fairly healthy space to say, you know what, that's not a message I'm going to listen to, or I think that leader was incorrect in saying that, or I think the church hasn't really done their homework on suicidality. If you're already in a space where you're suicidal, you're probably not in a great self-advocacy place. So this is where it's not just, I mean, we're trying to teach all of you something that hopefully you can take, but this is also a larger issue in our culture at large. And for any of you who are in leadership positions or in auxiliary leadership, It's important that you take these kinds of concepts back to your wards and stakes, or invite people like us to give trainings to bishoprics or stake presidencies, and we're always willing to do that because these kinds of things are so important and can have really devastating effects. So I don't know if either one of you want to. I spoke a lot on that.
And one thing I like how you mentioned different systems. And just to add on to that, we are all part of different, you know, systems, and the culture has an effect on us. And I feel like sometimes we, rather than if we're in a healthy place, because if we're not, that's okay if we can't do this, but rather than blame a family member, to kind of maybe look at some of, like, the systems that maybe they're a part of, and that can maybe help us have empathy. Again, we first need to take care of ourselves, and it's okay if we're not in a place to go there. I did see one positive. I mean, there was recently a positive step, although it probably didn't go far enough, and it's not perfect, but there was a video addressing how suicide is not a sin.
And so just to take this example all the way through, then handing it over to you to consider the Mormon cognitive distortions you've experienced or you've encountered. So examples of thinking that mental health is a deficit or a moral character flaw. That's an overgeneralization. That's jumping to a lot of conclusions, right? Someone ending their life connected to sin. I don't know where that leap was made, but a leap was made, right?
Jumping. That's not a Mormon idea. That's a huge Christian puritanical idea that Mormonism just kind of grew in the context of suicide being a sin. So we also have to look at the larger context of that. Unfortunate. People weren't able to bury their loved ones in cemeteries all over this country because of suicide, right? So that's not a Mormon thing.
Mm-hmm. Emotional reasoning, spiritual reasoning, all or nothing thinking are just some of the few cognitive distortions wrapped up into this kind of narrative that many of us have heard within Mormonism. A more rational approach, right? So either working with a therapist or just taking a step back and critically thinking, is there any evidence for that thought or any evidence for that narrative would be my mental health is not an indication of spiritual or moral worth. As humans, we all struggle, and it doesn't mean we have something wrong. It's normal to be sad occasionally. Anxiety and depression, actually, when you think about research, have biological factors that contribute to that person experiencing them. They're real. Mental illness is real, and there is no evidence, zero evidence that supports they originate due to sin. Right? So this is kind of how we're modeling what shows up, what cognitive distortions are present, and then how do we kind of come to a more rational understanding of that narrative, thought, or distortion. So I saw a few hands before. What ones come up for you? And if you could come to the mic, that would be awesome.
Unless you're going to shout out something quick, then I'll repeat it. But
one that I encountered last year was a cousin had there was something that came out that she was sharing on Facebook about how if you're sad, depressed, anxious, or struggling, it's because the devil's trying to get you. And I tried, I have family, close family members who have struggled with various mental illnesses, and I was trying to push back on that, saying, you know, this is actually a real physical thing, and you should get some real physical help. Not her, but, you know, the concept. And there were so many people that were like-minded with her who were sort of pushing back and saying, no, this was so helpful to me. And I was, you know, it just made things so much better because now I knew where these things were coming from. And it was kind of hard to get any traction there. Is that something that you've seen?
Yes. Is that all I have to say? Well, and this is where it does get kind of back to the point and the question in the back about are cognitive distortions ever useful. I will be just very vulnerable and open about the Satan dialogue used to be helpful to me for a while. So it's kind of like that idea, you know, before I was a mental health practitioner and, if I'm struggling with this, I know where that's coming from. It's not me. It's some other entity that's attacking me, and so it actually helped me feel better about myself. And I know how to deal with that. I can, you know, be a good Mormon girl and pray and read my scriptures, and then that power won't be as present. And for me, because I don't think I have some of the genetic factors of clinical depression, it actually made me feel better. So what's the cognitive distortion there? If I just would have gone forward, not understood mental health, when I'm the next young women's leader, what do I say based on my experience? It worked for me, therefore it must work for all of you. Let me tell you how it is, right? And it was the only reason I have any reality checks in my life, quite frankly, is because I've worked with all of you. You know, so many people in my office who said, that's not working. I'm like, really? Oh, well, I better do my homework, right? Or I got my education and it got my, you know, got my homework. So it's difficult to make space for things that other people find useful when we feel there's harm in that. That is very hard. And I'm guessing most of us have a loved one, or maybe are dealing with some of those things ourselves, where that's the position we're in, right? Something that you know, for example, you know, having bishops' interviews when I was 12 and 13 was really helpful for me. It was really helpful for me to have somebody ask me about my sexuality when I was 12 or 13. I felt supported, and I felt, you know, like somebody really cared about my life. Whereas a lot of us are feeling like that was a breach of your boundaries, right? Or that was a breach of things like that. So it's very difficult when you are up against lived experience that is different from your own, or that actually is challenged by some mental health standards of care. So it's complicated. It's complicated. And so how do we make space? And I said this in our earlier thing, a strategy that I use a lot is just saying, well, For me, this isn't always a useful paradigm because of these reasons. The sandwich approach, I can see how that might be helpful for some. That's the bread. I'm not sure it's helpful for all because A, B, C, and D, that's the meat. But I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts with me, more bread, right? So that you're not just saying you're wrong and what's wrong with you, right? Or how can you think that way? Because then our defensiveness comes up and people retrench. You're not going to convince them or have an open discussion to anything, because as soon as your defense mechanisms go up, you're going to retrench. So is that a useful answer to that? Okay.
And before we answer this question, Sue, what time it is, just so we can keep ourselves honest.
4:20.
Okay, sweet. Okay, thank you. In the back, please.
Yes.
You can't raise healthy, happy kids outside of the Mormon church. That's what I just said. You can't raise happy, no, thank you. That's what I'm doing. You can't raise happy, healthy children outside of the church. Because, of course, you know, the 13 million microscopic Mormon world are the only people that are happy in the world. But yes, you're absolutely correct. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, another one. All of the good things that happened in my life are because of the church. All of the bad things that happened in my life are because somehow I failed.
Yeah, my mom said that.
Yeah, that's his mother. Thank you.
Yeah.
In the very back. I had a spiritual confirmation on my mission, therefore everything that the church does or says has to be true. Yeah. All or nothing thinking.
And
yes.
We see the others.
You just need to pray more, fast more, go to church more. Regardless of whether you've been doing that nonstop for the last 6 weeks.
Right. Any struggle that you have, you need to pray more, fast more, go to church more. Whatever it is, more.
Yeah, I definitely in my office see a lot of that thinking of self-blame, of owning things that aren't really ours to own, that aren't our faults. Yeah, and that's definitely part of all or nothing thinking.
I want to go back to the comment that regarding all or nothing. No, the, oh, it was so good. Jumping to conclusions. The thought that I had one really meaningful spiritual experience, and therefore that is the conclusion that every other entity of an organization is accurate, truthful, and correct, right? That's an overgeneralization. It's also all or nothing thinking. We're also doing those should statements. You should do this, and the result is this, right? You should be able to read your scriptures and pray harder, and you should receive peace.
There's also the other side of that, of, you know, there's some mistakes that leaders have made, or one part of this is wrong. Therefore, nothing is valuable in it. So there's both sides.
Yes. Okay, well, so if you turn down a calling according to a previous bishop, you're giving up your space in the celestial kingdom, meaning your wife will have to find another celestial mate. That's really exciting, Cindy. I'm really happy for you. Mm-hmm. Okay, the possibilities, yes.
Natasha, can I pause right there? Yes. Just that's a perfect example, one of mind reading and also fortune telling, which is the expectation that a situation will turn out badly without any evidence.
Ooh, I like that. Any evidence. Sarah, I'm stealing that. Okay. Yes, you and then you in the green shirt.
What I care about most, my friends won't accept me if they knew my
the people I care about most will not accept me if they knew my new Mormon identity.
Yes. Can I sit with a rational approach to that, right? The reality is some might not be able to sit with you in that, and yet probably if we have a rational approach, some are still going to be there, right? Oftentimes we're trying to make sense and also reduce disconnection or reduce trauma in our life. And sometimes our cognitive distortions exaggerate the truth to make us feel safer. Instead of, it also limits us. So we don't see, yeah, if I am open and honest about my faith transition, some people might not be able to support me in that. But are there people who will? So it's not all or nothing.
Thank you. And you have?
Yes. We have a question and answer session planned. I'm wondering if we're kind of doing that now.
Yeah.
So would you like to just continue the way we are rather than separate into specific question period in about 5 minutes? Just keep going.
Okay. I didn't even know that was an option, so I'm not even giving that to them. Thank you, Sue.
All right, we.
Yes, right here.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, okay, we have a leader that has said, I have the keys every single talk for like 6 years or something before they took him out to go be a mission president. But anyway, I have the keys, therefore, if you obey me, you will be blessed if you do what I say, even if I'm wrong.
Oh.
Yeah, so if you, so I have the priesthood keys, and therefore, as long as you obey me, even if I'm wrong, you will be blessed. Actually, Elder Oak said this. Yes, yes.
And we want to move forward to talking about next steps, about how do you challenge us when you see this within yourself. So other examples that we had is if you create a faithful home, your family will be protected from all trials or danger. A rational approach would be, my religious practices can give me strength, but do not prevent challenges, right? Like, where is there some balance in this thinking so it's not all or nothing? Another common example that I see with clients is the hardest way to live is the best way. Life is meant to be hard.
You know, the really righteous people took extra packages of the problems upstairs. Do you remember that one?
So I don't know where the scripture, where like we're also made for joy, comes in with that, but... So we make thousands of accommodations in our everyday life to create ease. The hardest parts of life are normal. It's okay to find ways to make it easier, right? So like, how do we get some evidence behind kind of these big thought patterns? Who's heard that we choose our trials and everything happens for a reason? We talked about this can be protective and this can be incredibly detrimental given the individual and given the circumstance. Can you kind of sit with yourself and know those for yourself? what trials you wish you picked and those feel empowering versus the ones that feel like there's no way there's a loving creator if that showed up?
Thank you.
Our trials for me played out that I was not valued in the premortal council. Ergo, I was suffering in this life to atone or compensate for some failed values in a premortal life. Those two get tied together rather frequently.
Right. So the idea being, I'm going to botch this, but the idea being that choosing your trials in the premortal life, especially with what you've gone through here, can feel like you weren't either worthy in the premortal life or something along those lines. Yeah. Thank you.
With no evidence, right? Magical
no.
thinking.
With no
with
evidence.
No evidence. Generalizations, all or nothing thinking, spiritual reasoning, no doctrine to support that either. Thank you, Sue.
Okay, so the idea that we all came here with a limited amount of intelligence.
Like there's one that has all of it, he's the bomb. And there's some that are pretty good, some that are smaller.
Right. 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 Thank you. Thank you.
And can you
did you have any?
We do have some suggestions on how to next. So how do we examine your belief and expectations?
Yeah. I like asking these questions. I think this can be very helpful. Of course, you know, are we being unrealistic with ourselves? Are we being perfectionists and having, you know, we have to do everything? What's the evidence? We've talked a lot about that. Are there ways?
Can I just so usually on the evidence thing, there usually is some evidence. There's some evidence, kind of like a joke, there's some truth. But it's not all the evidence. So you have to be really careful about that. Kind of like with the example of, well, if I do wrong things, that's going to lead to depression. Well, yeah, maybe if you did something to hurt another person, you feel guilt or sadness around that. Oh, well, that must be true. Then it's leading to depression, right? So that's a good example of how a little bit of evidence leads to this incorrect idea about depression overall.
Go ahead. Yeah. Let's see. Are there other way, or how is believing this way affecting me? Looking at that, and how useful is this belief in my life? Is it really helping me? Because often a lot of our beliefs are self-defeating beliefs, and might be more harmful, and other times they're helpful. So I think it's important to look at that.
We handed a putting your thoughts on trial worksheet, which is like a very basic cognitive behavioral therapy. And if you didn't get the handout, come visit us and I'll make sure you get one to your email. But oftentimes it's just the pause. It's the pause to look at those beliefs and really strategically think through, is there any evidence? Because I think it's this radical introduction to think, don't believe everything you think. Thoughts are just that, thoughts.
Well, and this is one of the cognitive distortions that we've been taught, actually, in Mormonism, is that your thoughts will lead to actions, that your thoughts are defining of who you are, that your feelings, kind of like the example about having a spiritual experience, do, especially if they're warm, fuzzy feelings, do collaborate what's being taught, you know, because that's, quote-unquote, the spirit. And for sometimes that's very meaningful, and other times that can corroborate really unhealthy or unhelpful ideas. One last thought I'd like to make sure I make time for is this idea that any culture, and specifically religion or family system, will have an explanation for both sides of the coin. And this happens specifically in Mormonism a lot. So for example, if you feel discomfort, so let me just ask this for a minute. When you think of the word discomfort, the yucky feeling, what does that generally remind you of? Where does that come from in Mormonism? Who? Satan. So what about when you're uncomfortable paying your tithing? Is that from Satan? No, that's just like personal growth. So I'm just saying the culture will change the narrative to serve the culture. Okay? So if I pray, like my daughter did right before her baptism, somebody had parked a car blocking everybody's cars. So she and her sweet little 8-year-old self made, you know, said a prayer, and voila, she said amen. Grandma found the keys. Oh, prayer works. That was a really spiritual experience for her, for our whole family. It really was. Prayer works. Now we have the cancer, you know, the sister who's dying of cancer in my ward. She's got 4 little kids under the age of 10. Do you think we prayed for her? We prayed, we fasted, we took casseroles, we prayed more, we fasted more, and she died within 3 years. Did we say prayer doesn't work? No, we redid the narrative. There's some other reason. Maybe she's needed on the other side of things, right? Or maybe God knows what's best in this particular situation. Or maybe her husband needs this trial to be a better person in his life. Whatever explanations, again, most of them not helpful in a moment of grief, that people give, because we change the narrative. The narrative isn't ever, in our church anyway, oops, we got it wrong. Sorry. That's not the narrative. The narrative is usually put back on who? On you. You're not doing something right. You're not having the right testimony. You're not leading your family the right way. You're not doing your gender roles correctly. You're not doing your sexuality correctly. You're not doing your spirituality correctly. Anything can be explained from that lens. I'm not saying that the church is necessarily, again, like, it's not like it's like, ho, 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 we can't wait to do this to you. These things happen in systems like this. So just be aware of that. Be aware of that and see how useful that is showing up in your life, and be willing to push back against some of those messages.
And one thing that's been helpful for me is to know that I get to be the authority of my own life. I get to define what the trials of my life mean, you know, and that takes me time. You know, the idea that the trials of my life, when people tell me, everything happens for a reason, when I'm in pain, crying on the floor, it's not so helpful. but as I have that my support system, I can figure out for myself what my own trials, the meaning that those will be to me, and what different things. And I would love for everyone to feel like they have that authority to do that with their own experiences, because you're the expert on your own life.
And then, Sue, do we have time for a question and answer section? Yeah, we have 10 more minutes.
We actually can give you questions.
Anyone who hasn't had a turn?
Over here. And come up to the mic, please, if you're going to do questions.
We got in.
It's not about our room, it's about the recording.
They want you recorded.
Sorry.
I know.
Okay, so when we're dealing with people, either family members, friends, church friends, whatever, and we see where we've got this dissonance where they're not able to break that trend of going around in a circle, of feeling horrible, and this is my fault, and this is, you know, and kind of going around and around. And they're a very emotional being, so talking to them rationally does not work. How do we help break that trend and help them move to a better spot?
Yeah, come in. Come in again. Oh, Sue's telling us. We listen to Sue.
We like Sue.
Now this is in
their
faces, so.
Okay. Of course, you probably have heard a lot from me already, Monica, but I think a good place to start is to listen and to hear and to sit with people and really understand where they're coming from, and wait to give any advice. But when they feel validated, that I think is the most important thing. And then if they're open, you can go further. But first you have to kind of gain that trust by doing that.
So Lisa Butterworth and I did a podcast on Mormon mental health about cognitive distortions, and I think I've done one with Jennifer Finlayson Fife too. But anyway, believe it or not, we are not rational beings. I know you all think you're really smart in here, but we are not. We shift our ideas primarily from an emotional space, and then we have rational thoughts about it. So, because otherwise, anybody who has the same information would come to the same conclusion. And how many of us realize that does not work in the political realm, in the religious realm, right? We're all reading the same book, and we're all coming to very different conclusions. And that's because as you're reading something logically, it's filtering through the system of your emotions and your lived experience. And a lot of that is subconscious. That's your elephant, right? We have the rider that we think is so smart, and that all of our decisions come from the rider. But I don't know how many of you have tried to move an elephant that doesn't want to move. And so coming at... John Dolan says this in a good way when I've presented with him. Trying to change people's emotional decisions or emotional spaces from a rational perspective is going to be very ineffective. So her point about validation, that's emotional. That's sitting with somebody. That's not trying to convince them. Trying to step into a cheerleading role or a fixer role, that's usually not going to go well for you because people don't want to be cheer-led or fixed unless they're paying somebody to do that for them. Most people just want to feel understood. And so that can be difficult when you feel not understood from their reactions. But if your idea is to help another person, you have to really sit with some discomfort around that for a long time.
So about 3 years ago, my father passed away. And he had... he was married to my stepmom for over 20 years. Anyway, she's going through a lot of grief, and still, I don't, trying to do what I can to help her through that. So is there some advice you can give those going through those situations?
Can I ask you a question? Have you asked her what would be helpful?
I have, yeah. I've had a lot of conversations.
Okay.
With her. I'm pretty close to her, and I do everything I feel like I can, but sometimes I don't feel like it's adequate, you know. So she has a lot of, like, I don't know if I'd say a lot, but she'll go through situations where she has, like, panic attacks even, and so it's tough because you love someone and you don't know how to help them. So I know... It's a generalization. Yeah, yeah. Maybe a one-on-one basis would be better, but anyway, I just thought maybe if there's like some general.
No, I think guidelines. What you're getting at is very universal, which is this. I mean, how many people can relate to having a loved one that you're uncomfortable with the pain that they're going through? Right? I mean, I think that's a very universal position. Sarah, I feel like you're over there with no mic. Do you want to say something?
Well, I think... First of all, you're doing an awesome job by even being this aware, asking the question. Oftentimes we see people in pain and we freeze because we don't know what to do. So the fact that, like Natasha said, have you asked? Even saying things like, can I just sit with you while you're struggling? If there is a space, grief is cyclical. I talk a lot about this with clients. It's a circle. So oftentimes we want people just to move through it, like just be over it. But oftentimes grief comes back around, especially when it comes to a loss of a loved one. You know, possibly asking questions like, what gives you hope? Going from a strength-based perspective, so honoring the loss and the grief of that, but also asking questions, and we can definitely take some time outside of this room to think of some more strategic decisions. I'm seeing if they need some professional help whenever I hear about panic attacks. That's beyond the normal human experience and grief, right? Like that's an exaggerated grief emotion. And so I always want to check, is that out of balance? Is there anything we need to do to support wellness at a higher level? So we'll talk a little bit more about that. I think it comes back to the cognitive distortion too, that if we have to be really careful when we watch someone suffering, that we're not doing enough, or that it's because we haven't figured it out for them. So we have to make sure we're not bringing in cognitive distortions into our interactions with those who are really suffering. And you better believe that is so hard.
Not making it about ourselves, because that's very easy to do. To make it about ourselves when they're the one that maybe needs the support and the grief. Also, I mean, there's no right timetable for grieving. That's going to look different for people in different situations. And there is a lot of support you can get with it. There's a lot of resources. I've recently learned more about like the tasks of grief that kind of can help people. Move through that. But again, no timetable for that.
And as we kind of think about closing, I just want to talk about when you think about growing a muscle, you have to do it over and over and over again. So if you're noticing that you have some favorite cognitive distortions, and I have my favorite ones, I want you to know, and if you are going to challenge them, it's going to take continual practice. And it's also going to take so much patience, kindness and compassion with yourself. The very first step is awareness. So what ones do you usually go to in high moments of stress, anxiety, or tension, right? And then moments when those experiences happen and you can step back and say, oh, I should it all over myself. I said all of these things that I should be doing, and the reality is I only needed to do one. So it's pausing after the fact, and then continually practicing stepping into that awareness to build our muscle to start challenging these cognitive distortions and cognitive narratives that many of us have had for the majority of our lives. So I want you to know that if this is hard for you, that makes sense. If you need mental health support or wellness coaching support to be able to pinpoint how these cognitive distortions are impacting your functioning, help is available. Right? Sometimes we can't do this alone. It's taking someone else to sit with and really trying to figure out where is the rational understanding of a belief that we have ingrained into our system. So I just want you to know that there is help. You're not alone, and that it's going to take practice, kindness, and compassion to get to challenge our cognitive distortions, which we all have. And thank you all so much for your time. And we'll be at a booth out here if you have any questions.